Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 7th, 1998. And today, in the Koinonia Fireside Room this morning, we have Tom Kennedy. Today's session is number 98-4, and it's a session on temptation. Let's listen in.
So, let's go ahead and start. My name is Tom Kennedy. I teach at Valparaiso University. Valparaiso, Indiana. I teach philosophy. So I don't teach John Howard Yoder in my classes there. So it's a great opportunity and a fun thing for me to be spending some time rethinking and remembering Yoder's contributions to our talk. So in these sessions, we're trying to honor Yoder's life and work and give thanks to God for Yoder's witness in his writings. We're trying to understand what he had to say that might be helpful to us in thinking out our lives and how, what decisions we should make and what ways of life we should engage in and what practices are relevant to living out our lives. For those of you who to whom Yoder is new, just a very brief information on him. He grew up in the Mennonite tradition, not the most, well, a fairly conservative wing of the Anabaptist movement. The Anabaptist movement were the radical reformers. Those at the Reformation period parted company with Luther and Calvin, emphasizing believers' faith and the believers' church, a community in which those who were able to confess the faith were to be baptized and live out their lives. Yoder grew up in the Mennonite tradition, started out his career working in missiology, actually, trying to think through what it would mean to be a Mennonite and to be engaged in world mission. Was appointed to teach at the Mennonite Seminary, Associate General Seminary in Goshen, Indiana, where his dissertation work had been in church history, and so he did his work there, teaching in history as well as doing New Testament studies and ethics. Eventually moved over to the University of Notre Dame, where he was working primarily with graduate students. He started attracting significant attention in the American theological circles really back in 1972 with the publication of The Politics of Jesus. And since that time, published, I suspect 8 or 10 works, some of them academic, some of them popular. Always tried to keep his hand in more popular publications, collections of sermons as well. Yoder died this past December, one day after his 70th birthday. Today, the aspect of his thought that we want to deal with is what he called the Constantinian heresy. One way to start off our thinking about these issues is let me read a couple of paragraphs from his Politics of Jesus, 1972 publication. He writes, "Frequently the faithfulness of the church has been put to the test the moment believers were asked to follow the path of costly conscientious objection in the face of the world's opposition. Yet we should not overdramatize the normal expression of our mission in and through society. The church's calling is to be the conscience and the servant within human society. The church must be sufficiently experienced to be able to discern when, where, and how God is using the powers." Now we'll say some more about the powers later. For the time being, think of the powers as a sort of structures of human life and society. political structures, economic structures, social structures, religious structures, and so on. So the church's calling is to be the conscience and the servant within human society. The church must be sufficiently experienced to be able to discern when and where and how God is using the powers. Whether this be thanks to the faithful testimony of the church or in spite of its infidelity. Either way, we are called to contribute to the creation of structures more worthy of human society. But the church will also need to be sufficiently familiar with the manifest ways in which God has acted to reconcile and call together a people for himself, so as not to fall prey to the Sadducean or German Christian temptation to read off the surface of history a simple declaration of God's will. God is working in the world, and it's the task of the church to know how God is working. The church should be the first to distinguish between this kind of divine work, which can be discerned definitively and faithfully, not only in the light of faith, and the to and fro on the surface of current events, concerning which many, even many in the church, will exclaim, "Behold, here is the Christ. This is where God is at work." This task of discernment is much less simple than seems to be assumed by many who in the last decade have been encouraging us to look for God at work in the world revolution, whatever that is. It was words penned in 1972. So look at it. It seems to me we can move from that to say there are two dangers we face. On the one hand, it would be a mistake, or it's a danger which confronts us. One danger is an inability or a refusal to see at what work in the world God really is active. If we refuse to see where God is at work in the world, or if we're unable to see where God is at work in the world, that's a mistake, Yoder's suggestion is. God is present in the world working. We need eyes to discern that. So if we aren't able to perceive that, something's gone wrong somehow. On the other hand, another mistake is seeing God at work in the world in places at which God really is not at work. Mistakenly identifying structures or actions or activities as places where God is at work, when those aren't really places where God is at work. Those seem to be two dangers which confront us. Can you think of examples of either of those mistakes being made? Examples in which many you or I or many people fail to see God at work at the world where God really is at work, or this will have to be retrospective, of course, or examples in which probably the second mistake is much more easy for us to identify, examples in which people have said, "Here God is at work," when we can with some confidence say, "No, that's a mistake."
I have an example of that one. It's not my example. Someone from our Bible study gave it an hour ago or so, and it just struck me. The idea that that when a child dies, you know, God took the child to be with God. Mm-hmm. As if somehow that's God at work. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem to me to be right. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the right explanation. I don't think that's...
Yeah, at the very least, it's got to be a much more messy, complicated account than that.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
When people point to riches or fortunes and say it's because they lived a godly life.
Yeah, okay. So people flourishing, prospering financially, and they attribute that this is God's blessing.
Because I'm such a good person or whatever.
Okay.
Pick any war. Both sides, God is on.
Okay, yeah. So sort of, this is what we're doing is God's will. God is with us. And, yeah.
I think our temptation, the human temptation on the other side, is to look at any great suffering. And this is the argument many people say, well, how can there be a God if there's such great suffering? And the failure to see Christ present in that suffering.
Mm-hmm. Are there certain types of suffering where you're confidencing somehow Christ is present there, and other types of suffering which you're less confident in saying, well, yes?
Probably from a personal point of view, when I see it happening someplace else, I sort of know, you know, Christ is present when it's happening to me. You know, it's maybe a different story.
Mm-hmm. Or, for instance, the Holocaust.
Yeah.
I think Christ would be present on the victim's side of things, but not on the perpetrator's mm-hmm. side of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's the classic case of enlisting the Nazi enlistment of God.
Didn't Elie Wiesel say there's a famous story about watching a hanging at a concentration camp, and somebody in the crowd said, "Where is God?" Mm-hmm. And the answer was, "God is there." Mm-hmm. The person.
When we've identified in our discussion right here, when we've identified the cases in which we feel confident that God is at work in the world, our examples have tended to be, it seems to me, personal examples. And examples, perhaps, of individual suffering. And we're saying, well, all right, where suffering is, there, in some sense, we can find God. Are you willing to push beyond that and say, well, no, that's not the only, those aren't the only places where we can confidently say this is the work of God still active in our world today? Are there other places beyond the personal realm where you can declare, surely, yes, this is the work of God?
Maybe the only one I think of is the fact that there is a church still existing. You know,
okay.
We say that God keeps the church going in spite of us.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Or perhaps the Jewish people as well. There's some sense in which the continuing existence of the Jewish people as well as the church is something of a miracle. Yeah. Other examples. What about the civil rights movement?
Is that, I'd say flawed as it was, that South Africa is no longer under apartheid. There were lots of
the end of
violence
apartheid
that did occur and haven't happened, but that the end result is certainly an improvement.
What about increasing democratization in the world? Is that the work of God? Or is that, I'm not tying things too close.
Mm-hmm. Americans probably see it that way.
Now, why don't you? You're,
no,
but,
I didn't
you're,
say
you're
I
suggesting
didn't.
You don't, or that that's a sort of narrow.
Well, I think we, you know, where we live, the life we know, mm-hmm. affects what we see, and we see democracy being godlike, mm-hmm. and I want to pull away a little bit from that.
Why do you want to pull away from it?
It's probably my nature. I think this summer I've been doing some reading that about leadership, and one of the books I read is called The Connective Edge, which talks about the interrelationships of the whole world. Peoples, all of the systems, all of the structures. Mm-hmm. And increasingly that's true. So maybe God is at work because mm-hmm. the world is becoming more democratic. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to be careful about seen our political system being the appropriate one for.
Yeah. There's
a lot of critical voices of democracy because of the connection to Americanism that we have to at least heed to. If we don't have the eyes to see it, then we probably don't, being in the midst of it, we at least have to listen to some of those other voices that become very critical. Any other, I think, is just, in a sense of, I don't think every leadership community group, scripturally, is a democratic group. So we have to struggle, not saying that's the only way, because there can't be cutting edges. But we still got to at least open the opportunities that there might be other ways.
Okay. We'll come back to this. I'm not going to let you have your words here, but later we'll circle back and we'll give you your time. I know not all of us here are Lutheran, but if you are Lutheran, you're eager to have a paradox wherever you can get one. And I'm seldom enthusiastic about paradoxes, but at least it just struck me that here's a paradox from Yoder that I can offer you, and on those occasions I want to take advantage of it. So here's a paradox for you from Yoder's thought. If you were in the session yesterday, one of the things we talked about is what Yoder identifies as the five marks of the church. And what Yoder says about each of those five marks of the church is that what we should expect to see, since these five marks of the church are somehow capturing a deeper reality or are in sync with or fit with a deeper reality of things, then what we ought to expect to see, even in secular movements or non-religious movements, movements outside the church, we shouldn't be surprised to see these there, because they fit with the deepest nature of reality. And one of the things we said yesterday, one of the marks of the church was the open meeting, a sort of democratic element, Yoder suggests. There's some sense in which democracy at its core, in its emphasis upon equality of individual voices, that's a mark of the church, but it doesn't belong exclusively to the church. When we see it outside of the church as well, we ought to see God at work in the world, in a way bringing the church to recognize Christ the Lord of history, history recognizing in some more profound way what the nature of reality is. So I think on the one hand, Yoder would be willing to say that it wouldn't be a mistake to see increasing democratization of around the world as evidence of the lordship of Jesus over history, as evidence of God at work in the world today. No paradox yet. That's the first aspect of things. But now to get on with the main theme of today's session, the Constantinian heresy. So here's the paradox. In some sense, increasing democratization in the world today can be seen then as evidence of God at work in the world. But to identify any particular democratic nation, an American democracy, or democratizing movement at any particular place, to identify that with the way of God is to commit the Constantinian heresy, is to make a mistake. So, general affirmation of democratization across the globe, but refusal or worry about identifying any particular democratic movement with the will of God. The Constantinian heresy. What is the Constantinian heresy? The classic expression of the attitude in the Christian epoch is known as Constantinianism. So the reference is to Constantine. And Constantine, we know, what do we know about Constantine? What's the sort of basic details?
The emperor, yeah.
the Holy Roman Emperor. No, not. But he was the emperor that instituted Christianity as the official religion.
Yeah, he was
the world.
Was a pagan before going into battle. Presumably, he had some sort of mystical experience. Looked up in the sky, saw a cross. Goes into battle, wins the battle. Says that this must mean something. It must mean. At the very least, that we got to stop persecuting Christians. And so at least putting an end to harassing Christians. Actually, things didn't change with Constantine, but with Theodosius, I think around 380, something like that, with Theodosius. And that's when, under Constantine's influence, obviously, or he was a key player, but that's when the Christianity was affirmed as the religion of the empire. Well, the Constantinianism. The term refers to the conception of Christianity that took shape in the century between the Edict of Milan and the City of God, Augustine's City of God. The central nature of this change, which Constantine himself did not invent nor force upon the church, is not a matter of doctrine nor of polity. No, the central nature is this. It's the identification of church and world in the mutual approval and support exchanged by Constantine and the bishops. The church is no longer the obedient, suffering line of the true prophets. It has a vested interest in the present order. Has a vested interest in the present order of things and uses the cultic means at its disposal to legitimize that order. So an investment in the order of things, using the worship rites of the church to say, this order is good, it's okay, it's where things should be. The church does not preach ethics, judgment, repentance, separation from the world. It dispenses sacraments and holds society together. Christian ethics no longer means the study of what God wants of us, since all of society is Christian by definition, that is by baptism. Christian ethics must be workable for all of society. What's good for Christians is good for all of society. Christian ethics is not about what a particular community should be or do, but what human beings should be and do. Instead of seeking sanctification, ethics becomes concerned with the persistent power of sin and the calculation of the lesser evil. At the best, it produces Puritanism, and at the worst, simple opportunism. The Constantinian heresy is this, then. The church's missionary task is to call the principalities and powers to modesty, as Yoder puts it. Now I've got to make the principalities and powers reference better known to us. In Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 17, we get some very strange cosmological language from the epistle writer, Paul, or one of Paul's disciples. Very strange language here. Let's see what we can make of this. In referring to Christ, the writer says, he's the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him all things in heaven and on earth were created. Everything was created in Christ. Things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. All things have been created through him and for him. He himself is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in everything. Whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, he's the creator of all things in heaven and earth were created through him, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers. Well, Yoder's suggestion then is that in the early church, this idea of there being powers, thrones, dominions, principalities and powers, structures of creation, which are necessary for us to live our lives, we would have chaos without these ordering structures. And yet these structures are rebellious against God and the way of God. But what God has done in the life and death of Jesus and raising Jesus from the dead is defeat these principalities and powers. So the calling of the church as witnesses to what God has accomplished in raising Jesus from the dead and the life of the cross, raising Jesus from the dead, the witness of the church is to be the first fruits of God's new creative activity. And the calling of the church is to call these powers, these rebellious structures, to modesty. Their tendency is to claim too much for themselves over against God. The church's call is to call these powers to modesty. The Constantinian heresy, then, is the heresy of substituting obedience to the powers for constraint of them. The task of the church is to constrain, limit, call the powers to modesty. The Constantinian heresy is, instead of calling the powers to modesty, to obey them. Now, we'll just go through a little bit more of Yoder's history, and then we'll see what to make of all this. The first Constantinian heresy then took place when, under the influence of Constantine at Theodosius, the church allied itself with the Holy Roman Empire. Yoder says, as Constantinian heresies go, you could have done worse. Because as a matter of fact, what was taking place there at any rate was an identification of Christianity with a universal movement. I mean, the Holy Roman Empire was not just some small, limited group of people, but it had a universal component to it. So it's a mistake, but at least it had that going for it. Yoder then, in sort of ridiculous language, moves from that original Constantinian mistake to Neo-Constantinianism, to Neo-Neo-Constantinianism, to Neo-Neo-Neo-Constantinianism, to Neo-Neo-Neo-Neo-Constantinianism, and that's as far as he got, though it may be the case that in the near future we'll be able to continue that. What are the differences between these? Yoder says, in every case, their substance will be different, but the form will be the same. It'll be a case of the church embracing, allying itself with structures in the world. So Neo-Constantinianism takes place in the 17th century, the wars of religion in which, instead of identifying Christianity with the great Holy Roman Empire, Christianity is allied with some particular province or nation state. Luther's alliance with the German princes and so on. So no longer is the church allied with something beyond provincial or national boundaries, but with a much smaller. But still, the claim is, well, all right, here God is at work with the state at this time in this history. The result of this is the church becomes a servant of not a universal society, but a particular society, Germany or parts of France or whatever. The next Constantinianism, Neo-Neo-Constantinianism, takes place in the after the 18th century, the political revolutions, increasing secularization in the Western world. And in this context, although we have fewer and fewer states who identify themselves as Christian states, nevertheless, the church identifies itself and sanctions the activities and the works of some nation as such, blesses that society it inhabits, even without any sort of formal identification. So, for example, the United States, there's no official church-state relationship. There's, in fact, an official separation of church and state, but nevertheless, the church sanctions the work. This is a Christian nation, not a church-state connection, but still a Christian nation, and so God is on our side in some sense. Neo-Constantinianism is the alliance of church with, and this is probably the one that's most distant from us, certain movements which have actually been secularization movements, actually hostile to religion, but sometimes at various points we've had the church even endorsing those secular movements hostile to religion. In certain death of God theologies, for example, the claim would be, well, what's happening in the world is something that the church ought to identify with and endorse, even if it's at odds with what the church has historically believed. That's not a problem. This is the side that's going to win out, and we ought to ally ourselves with this movement at this time. Finally, neo-Constantinian movements, probably the best examples are recent and contemporary liberation movements, Christian Marxist movements, in which the suggestion is that God, on the side of the poor and the oppressed, endorses this particular revolutionary activity, using guns and weapons to overthrow the oppressive powers and achieve liberation. Yoder says what all of these different Constantinian movements have in common are three things. First and most importantly, each of these movements, so here's the critical mistake in Constantinianism, each of these movements identifies the true meaning of history and the true locus of salvation out there in the cosmos, somewhere out there in the world, not in the church. Yoder's suggestion, by contrast, is that the church, as the first fruits of God's new creation, that's where the true meaning of history takes place. If you want to see what reality is really like, that's where you should look, not out there in the world. Secondly, Yoder says, if we cooperate, each of these Constantinian movements makes this assumption, that if we cooperate with the world, we might assist the world in achieving the fullness of salvation that it's going to achieve with or without us. So the assumption is this movement is going to win, and it's going to win with us or it's going to win without us. But with our help, it might achieve the fullness of salvation that it might lack without our assistance. Thirdly, Yoder's suggestion is that in Constantinianization, the assumption is that it's the business of the church to identify with the good guys. That we can clearly identify bad guys and good guys, and it's the calling of the church to identify with the good guys. Those are the three mistakes in each of these. Yoder's suggestion is that there is an alternative to this Constantinian movement, and that alternative is the servant life of obedience in the church. Obedience, not efficacy. Yoder writes, it can be argued that this is the lesson of history. The Christian church has been more successful in contributing to the development of society and to human well-being precisely when it has avoided alliances with the dominant political or cultural powers. Why should we not expect it to be the same in the coming years if the church is going to make a worthy contribution? We would then not simply look out into the streets for the evident form of what is happening in the world in order to unite ourselves with this movement in the claim that it is God who is doing this. Not everything that is happening is the work of God. Instead of asking, what is God doing in the world, the church should ask, how can we distinguish, in the midst of all the things that are going on in the world, where and how God is at work? The answer to this question will not be found by reading on the surface of daily history, but by the spirit-guided understanding of the discerning community. In our age, many are profoundly impressed by the needs of the oppressed and tend simply to declare revolution is the will of God, feeling that to be a firm statement. But we need to learn to ask a more precise and profound question. In a world where revolutions of many kinds are popular and probable, what is the shape of the revolutionary servanthood to which the disciples of Christ are called? Whether it be in ancient or future society, this particular calling is to be not master, but servants. Thus, what we have to discern for the church is not a new way to establish a much more promising alliance with the most constructive powers that we can see at work in society, as much as to discern the shape of the moral independence that is demanded in order to exercise over against these powers the ministry that only the church can exercise, its constant call to sobriety and to respect for human dignity. Well, let me stop there and see where your questions or confusions or puzzles or, yeah.
Well, I guess I have a couple of reactions. One is when we first had the discussion of democracy, and the notion was that democracy is a good thing, and so we were starting to identify some good things, but wanted to avoid the mistake of having some concrete good thing that's out there in the world somewhere. I'm concerned that we're just heading towards these kind of Platonic forms that are out there, but we don't want to make the mistake of saying, well, this is good, we might be wrong about what's good. So we want to kind of divide things up into good and bad and say all the good is God's, but concretely, we're not sure, and we don't want to align ourselves, and so we'll just stick with the amorphous abstract out there somewhere. And I'm not sure what that has to do with anything. I mean, I'm not a Platonist, I suppose. And it seems
there are worse things to be than Platonists. But.
Yes. Well, and then my other reaction is this. Whether or not consent is given or we intellectualize and problematize and think about whether or not we are Constantinian, we are. Because we don't have to verbalize an assent to become a part. We are a part because if we use the list we had from Yoder yesterday, the breaking of bread, and interpret that as economic interdependence and sort of a real life depending upon each other. We break bread with Nike and Standard Gas Company, this, that, and the other, with everyone we do business with. They're the ones we're interdependent with, and we're so intermeshed in the society that we don't stand apart.
Yeah.
And so it's perhaps a convenience to say we don't align ourselves, or that's a mistake, and to identify the good as something that's so abstract that it's really just a
Okay. So
it's nothing.
So you have two different concerns. One concern is, well, isn't this too abstract and amorphous for it to be very helpful? And your second concern is, let's be honest with ourselves. There's no way of avoiding the Constantinian mistake Yoder talks about. Wouldn't it be better if we didn't deceive ourselves? That I take it
a year. Yeah, I'm saying that we haven't found a way, or we aren't seeking for a way. We're looking for superficial things or something along those lines, because we might as well be honest and say we don't live separately, we don't live apart, and what's the use of looking into the clouds for some good answer?
Okay, so he's got two concerns. Let's try to separate these from one another and deal with your first concern. Anyone want to handle it? The first concern is, it's just not very helpful. to talk about abstractions like democratization around the world as where God is at work in the world, if you can't point to specific democratic movements as examples of God at work in the world. Anyone want to? I mean, I hope I've characterized your concern.
Yeah, perhaps just to say it. There isn't some democracy out there in general. Nobody lives in general democracy. They live in a democracy here, there, or the other place with all the flaws of that democracy.
Anyone want to tackle?
Well, I guess I will just say that I'm in agreement of sorts. It's an interesting concept to think about democracy in general. It seems like something you would do around a discussion table or in a college classroom or a seminar such as this. But in our day-to-day lives, we need to make decisions about, do I support a particular political party? Who do I vote for? Mm-hmm. What do I teach my children? Am I going to be a conscientious objector? Am I going to exercise these freedoms? Do I really have all the freedoms that democracy says I should? Should I do a march for civil rights or for feminism or whatever? And that's the reality of our lives, our day-to-day lives and decision-making. So it does seem really divorced from that.
Well,
I would say another thing to add to that. I mean, I think that the even without the Yoder framework,
this is the voice of God.
Everybody's saying,
"Whoa, now we know."
I had a vision here, and I'm going to share it now with you. But actually, even without Yoder's framework, there's a certain, I think, basic realistic sense that one can say on the one hand that the world historical movement democracy is a positive good. I would add what Yoder adds to that, which is that part of its goodness resides in the fact that it taps into these deep structures of creation. But that in any given instance, it may not in fact be a good. I mean, the social scientists who have nothing to do with Christian frameworks would say that some of the worst and most atrocious instances in history were when certain societies attempted to export democracy suddenly when they didn't have a whole lot of other things in place that sort of nourish and sustain it. I mean, you can think of any number of popular movements, for instance, which are arguably democratic, that have been hideous in their consequences. So to bless an individual local instance because it's democratic would often backfire simply on secular grounds, never mind the framework that Yoder's working out of. And I think the framework Yoder's working out of adds to that the embarrassment of the church having sanctioned a popular movement, which turns out to be something like the terror, to take the French instance, or any number of things that happened in the immediate aftermath of the toppling of the czars and so forth, that turned out to be even worse, though arguably popular. So I think there's some just cautions built into the workings of secular society itself around the globe that would make one sensibly pro-democracy as a general movement throughout history, but very wary of baptizing any particular instance of it.
Yeah. And we started out with your concerns about identifying American democracy with God too closely. And it seems to me that's right. I think that's part of what Mark is saying. That's right. But on the other hand, it seems to me that we can, if Yoder's right, we can muster a good deal of enthusiasm. It's a mistake not to give thanks to God for the democratization movements at general in the world today, because it is a good thing for people to have some voice in their futures and in their destinies.
You know, is not the tension that we're feeling is we have this vision of an idealized democracy, and we have some sense of what that might be like, yet how it actually happens, the reality as it as it's instituted, forms that have, skin and bones. I mean, part of what we run into then is also, the fallenness of our own nature, that these institutions themselves are going to have problems. And the problems may even be more and more compounded as we get, our own sinfulness involved. But that's not to say we shouldn't have those those ideals and say, you know, those, you know, this is a good thing, this is what to aim for, as long as I think we also recognize, you know, perhaps some humanly unsolvable problems that are involved.
I think what he wants, though, is some way in which this kind of claim would really make a difference in the way we think.
And that's what you were looking for. You were looking for some practical. Well, all right. Here's one practical question. A lot of people aren't voting. If we just think of our current American context, how few people are voting in national elections. That is a practical issue, whether at least with those around us, we need to make efforts or efforts in our communities to... is this something that should trouble us if we think, in some sense, democratization correlates with the deeper meaning of things, with God's way in the world and history? Is it the case that we ought to be troubled about our current context, in which people feel so alienated from what's happening that they're not voting? Or is that a practical example, or is that missing your concern? Yeah.
Well, I guess there's of course all kinds of ways to interpret voter turnout, but I would say we do vote. We vote as consumers. We participate in the consumer society, and we vote for Nike and all these other corporations all the time. And the fact that the turnout at the polls is less than we may, a lot of people think good, just perhaps indicates the fact that politics is less important than economics. All kinds of interpretations.
But we can concede that. But then won't we say, well, what does that mean for democracy? That's certainly, if that's what our democracy looks like, that's not a very...
We're in trouble.
Yeah, but I thought we weren't going to give assent to any particular democracy and say that's...
Well, but surely we can think... Without thinking that God is on the side of American democracy, we can say, well, if democracy is somehow one of the deep truths of reality, then even though we don't identify this democracy as where God is exclusively or especially at work, we can say we would be a better people. We'd say this about the church, I think. Yoder would say we ought to say it about the church, and we can say it about wider society. If we see within the church examples of non-democratic movement, then what it means for the church to be an open meeting is to say we gotta have more democratic experience here in this context. So we can say that about the outside world as well, but in my saying that, I'm not being very democratic, so I'm talking too much. So,
with democracy comes, it seems to be embedded in democracy is the free market type of economy, mm-hmm. with your Nike and so forth. So for every blessing, for every good thing, there's the concern, or perhaps the bad thing, or the worries.
Or at least the temptation.
Temptation. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they're, democratic movements and the free market arose together. I think they're inseparable. So if you're saying democracy is a good thing, does that mean you're also saying that the free market is a good thing?
Well, that's a good question. Who wants to handle that?
God.
Well, it seems like, is democracy a political structure, or is it choices? You have to get back to that whole idea. If it's a political structure, it's one thing. But if it's able to express and make choices and do things on an individual basis, in other words, then a free market economy is democracy. And that, a serf back in Russia didn't have choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know. So mm-hmm. it does tie together with your Nike business and whatever, because it's a choice to buy Nike if you want to. I never buy a Nike, mm-hmm. but not because I worry about other things that are too expensive. But you know, what else? You know, it's a choice that I can make. Mm-hmm. And is democracy he's talking about, is that just the political structure, or is it all free choice?
Mm-hmm. You know, or some sort of self-determination and autonomy in some sense. Yeah. We need to get back to your second set of concerns, which is, this is really all self-deception. We are so embedded in the structures that to talk about the Constantinian heresy is just to miss the realities in which we live. I take it that was your concern. What about that?
I keep thinking about 1 Corinthians 13, where we see in part, you know, if we talk about, I haven't read Yoder, so I'm only going by what I've heard today, but, you know, these deep structures, I mean, we clearly cannot fully comprehend them. But I think we have to do the best we can with what we know. And, you know, as Christians, if we pause enough in this life of ours to pull back and allow God to work mm-hmm. through us, then there's some hope. I find it hopeful to think about those deep structures. That's mm-hmm. that seems like a hopeful thing to me.
Yoder certainly intends it to be yeah. hopeful. He develops this stuff in a chapter called Christ, the Hope of the World. So,
yeah.
I mean, the hope is that those structures, rebellious structures, aren't going to rule. They are going to be put in their place in the service of God's cause.
And finally, I have to be as alert as I can. I mean, as an individual, I think it's true for all of us to be as alert as we can and, mm-hmm. and aware and address mm-hmm. our lives mm-hmm. as positively and responsibly as we can.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things Yoder doesn't address these concerns so much to individuals as to the church, as to communities. And we may have a readiness to sort of think about, well, what does this mean for my individual life? But what would it mean for us individually or as the church? I'm not quite as skeptical or cynical as you are yet. What would it mean for us to call some structures to modesty? What would be examples? Can you think of any examples in which we might, and maybe it is easier to think about it individually, then what would be examples of in which we might call the powers to modesty?
The Vietnam War.
Okay, so,
that's all I can think of.
Or I mean, Yoder thinks any military conflict, that Yoder's belief is that the church's calling is to say no to the way of the sword, and so that calling that power, governmental powers, principalities, and thrones and dominions to modesty is to say no to the use of the sword.
I think one in the economic realm might actually be when we hold up ourselves as a wonderful example of the free market, and yet calling ourselves to modesty is understanding the abuses that we have within that system about people working for less than subsistence wages so that we can have those things.
Mm-hmm.
And us not recognizing it. I mean, I wasn't there at the Nike thing, and I've had my fair share of Nike shoes, and I'll probably get some in the future, but when we think of ourselves as this wonderful example of how great we're doing and mm-hmm. building the economy and helping everybody and everybody's situation getting better, then we find out that some fashion conscious people are buying shirts that are made by people who are basically in a trap situation working as slaves for years and years and years because of the structure. I mean, that's an embarrassment to all of us. And we need to calling ourselves to modesty is to make sure that when we make our claims about how great we're doing, that we're bird-dogging and watching for those things, those abuses that happen in our systems.
I like actually how you worded that. We call ourselves to modesty. Our tendency maybe is to sort of sit on the outside and while look at the structures, but the fact is the structures themselves, a free market system, I think you'd have a hard time saying there is something, you know, inherently, intrinsically evil about it. I think that the structures themselves can go one way or the other. It's what kind of power we put into those structures, and the extent to which we're willing to call ourselves to some modesty, we're able to, you know, hopefully begin to rein in, if it's not too late, you know, what we've created.
Mm-hmm. If we go back to the suggestion that people vote by being consumers, I mean, that seems to me to, as an example of, well, there's a rebellious structure trying to claim more than its territory, and so part of what it might mean to call that economic structure to modesty is to try to reawaken in people that's not how you vote, that's not how you form a community and a good way for people to live by your consumption, but rather by forums in which individuals in community voice their concern.
The interesting thing is that you're talking about a church structure, you know, that we are supposed to be doing this. The whole idea of boycotts. You know, on the one hand, you have the boycott of Nike or of Grapes or of various liberal, what you might call liberal ones. Then you have the other ones, boycott Disney, mm-hmm. or boycott. You know, and we say, well, we go with this one, we don't go with that one, you know. Mm-hmm. Are they both valid then, for the churches to boycott whatever they want to, either side of the fence? Is it according to Yoder, is that part of what we're supposed to do?
Well, I think Yoder's view is that the churches are to be communities of discernment. Yoder, I mean, says it in a number of places, he's not going to draw any big blueprint of what the perfect society would look like. That's not how we live in the world. So I think Yoder's suggestion would be, it's entirely possible that the church in Valparaiso would make a decision, would see what's happening there and in the world as they understand it, would make a decision for an action in that place that the church in Tacoma wouldn't do the same thing. So priorities may well differ from place to place. It may be the case that some sort of boycott is a way of calling the powers to modesty. The difficult thing, question you raise, is well, what if we have, as we do have, churches whose moral discernment differs, that one church thinking that's a problem and another church not thinking that's a problem. But certainly in terms of the way things could go, I think Yoder's view is that different priorities in different places.
But in the long run, let's just say that we have a thing like boycotting Nike, which means we're going to buy Adidas, and the other church that boycotts Adidas, you know. Well, in effect, do we have any, does it have any effect upon the world whatsoever if we've got, you know, Christian groups on the opposite sides of the fence boycotting each other?
Yeah.
What good does it do for the world?
That may, I think maybe the deeper question beneath that is raises questions about boycotts and whether that's a way, an effective way of operating or achieving. But certainly Yoder's suggestion is that, well, here's something that a church ought to think about, is what does it mean not to be captive to economic powers? And how is it that we can live our lives as a community in such a way that we aren't giving our primary obedience to these powers, which we know are rebellious and will try to claim more of us in a way they shouldn't? How do we do that?
Well,
one of the things that struck me when you were talking about the economic structures tending to claim more or need modesty would be the way in which special interest groups are having a tremendous effect on how our democracy is working. Mm-hmm. And but addressing that imbalance would address both how well the democracy we have is fulfilling the ideal of giving each of us a voice, theoretically an equal voice, and the fact that the economic structures are gaining in power.
Mm-hmm. Is Yoder just calling for the church to be one more special interest group in that competition? Or do you worry that Yoder's sort of sounds like he's calling us to opt out of things, quietism, all right?
Mm-hmm. Well, that might be a big improvement over many situations, a typical situation, because at least there would be the example of the difference, and I suppose to call the power structures to modesty, or however it was phrased, presupposes a community that is characterized as a community that is modest, or has modesty. And unless you're living in a town, a city, or someplace where the Christians are known to be, or this congregation in this neighborhood is known to be,
or this part of this congregation,
sure, is known to be a group that are modest. Mm-hmm. There's no sense in calling anybody
to modesty. Again, when I think about this stuff, it seems, I mean, the challenges are the mobile society in which we live runs at odds with the sort of what you need to establish a community which could really live out in an adequate way. What Yoder is proposing, what you really have to have, it seems to me, to achieve the sort of community that can effectively call powers to modesty, requires a commitment to this group of people and an openness to this group of people that few of us in the contemporary American world are. My life has certainly been a life of hopping from one place to another, to another, to another, and that being the case, I'm cut off from the bonds of community that may be necessary to effectively accomplish this. Our time is up. Thank you for your comments and insights and observations and helping me think through this. There will be one final session on Yoder tomorrow afternoon at 6:20. Christian Life, Death, and Social Ethics, I think, is the title. But there we'll try to confront more directly than we have heretofore Yoder's pacifism. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you.